This episode is brought to you by Windrose Recovery, a family of premier addiction treatment programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Privately owned, Windrose Recovery offers a full continuum of personalized care for those struggling with addiction, including the Manor for residential treatment, Midwest Detox for inpatient detoxification, and Windrose Counseling for outpatient treatment. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love is struggling with addiction, call Windrose Recovery at 414-409-5300. You can learn more about Windrose Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting WindroseRecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of the show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Mike, I am Ellie, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
Nowhere to run, nothing to hide from the government's prying eye. Take yourself a summer holiday.
The Path to Authenticity proudly supports the I Speak Media Foundation, advancing media literacy education through an evolving series of outreach programs within the communities that need it most. For more information, visit ispeakmedia.org. First time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity. Episode 113 for March 9th, 2021. On this day in 1541, Amerigo Vespucci was born. In 1788, Connecticut became the fifth state in the United States. In 1796, Napoleon married Josephine in Paris. In 1824, Leland Stanford was born. In 1839, the French Academy of Science announced the advent of the daguerreotype. In 1841, the rebel slaves who'd seized the Spanish slave ship, the Amistad, in 1839, were freed by the Supreme Court despite Spanish demands for extradition. In 1862, the first and last battle between the ironclads, the USS Monitor, and the CSS Virginia ended in a draw. On this day in 1864, General Ulysses S. Grant was appointed Commander-in-Chief of the Union Forces. In 1916, Pancho Villa led 1,500 horsemen on a raid of Columbus, New Mexico, killing 17 U.S. soldiers and citizens. On this day in 1918, Mickey Spillane was born. In 1930, jazz saxophonist Ornette Coleman was born. In 1934, the first man to orbit planet Earth, the Russian cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin, was born. On this day in 1936, the German press warned that all Jews who were to vote in the upcoming elections would be arrested. Bobby Fischer was born on this day in 1943. In 1959, the Barbie doll was unveiled at a toy fair in New York City. in 1964, the first Ford Mustang rolled off the Ford assembly line in Detroit. In 1967, Joseph Stalin's daughter Svetlana defected to the United States. In 1968, General William Westmoreland asked for 206,000 more U.S. troops in Vietnam. And on this day in 1986, U.S. Navy divers found the crew compartment of the Space Shuttle Challenger, along with the remains of the astronauts. So this episode features a guy named Mike Iamelli, and this conversation really got my wheels turning. I enjoyed it a lot. Just my kind of guy. Very thoughtful, kind, and just loved having him on the podcast. So hope you enjoy it. Mike Iamelli.
I'm aligned, zany, free, unmistakable, successful, and vulnerable. And I know that probably doesn't make any sense to anybody, but hopefully it will in a few minutes. So what I do for work is I help people to kind of map their lived experiences and figure out which levers they just naturally pull every time they're successful and fulfilled in life. And so, you know, we've all got areas in our life where we're successful, even if we swear, you know, our life is a mess. Where we're all over the place. We've got, you know, areas where we might have a good friendship or a good relationship, or we've done well in, you know, a project at school or at work. And, you know, we'll kind of find that there are these patterns, these sensitivities that we're just most sensitive to in life. And so my work is really kind of going across the board, across moments of trauma, moments of success, moments of fulfillment, moments of despair, and figuring out what are those sensitivities? What are you most sensitive to? And how do we start building a life that just feels like you?
Wow. So how did you come to do this kind of work?
Oh boy, this is a story. So, you know, I was successful pretty early in life. I actually started a public relations agency when I was 22 years old. And I was working with a lot of, you know, celebrities, healthcare politicians, some of the tech billionaires, those type of people. And I did that for a while. I really enjoyed my work, but I woke up one day a few years later and I was vomiting blood. And as you can imagine, it was pretty scary. That didn't stop for a few months. I was vomiting blood every single day. And I was really afraid that I was going to die. You know, I thought something desperately must be wrong with me. I was, you know, in and out of the emergency room, seeing different doctors, being diagnosed with a few different things. And really just opening up to alternative medicine, because at this point I thought, you know, what do I have to lose? And every day I was trying reflexology or Reiki or acupuncture or whatever I could to try to heal. And so at this time in my life, I had two roommates. And one of them was my older sister's friend. She had just moved to the city, so we, you know, had her come live with us. And she had a boyfriend, so she spent about half the week at his house. And the other roommate was a guy I knew from college who was a medical professional. And so just kind of by default, he was the one that was there. And I, you know, couldn't drive myself. I mean, I was so sick. I actually had an accident at work. I shit my pants at work.
Oh, my God.
It got really, you know, that was an experience. It got really ugly, and I couldn't get off the couch some days. I was in horrible pain. I couldn't, you know, drive myself anywhere. And so he, this guy, Garrett, he really became my caretaker. And he drove me to appointments. He cooked for me. And, you know, probably 2 months into this experience, I realized I felt something different for him. And, you know, at the time, just to give you a reference into my frame of mind, I had never been with a man, never consciously interested in a man, to my knowledge. So this was strange. And it didn't feel sexual. It didn't even feel romantic. It just felt, I feel something here, and I don't know what that is. And I think, you know, had this been any other time in my life, I would have assumed that just brush under the rug, this isn't really anything. But here I was thinking I could die tomorrow. And so if I could die tomorrow, you know, am I really being honest? Am I living a, you know, authentic life to, you know, talk about the point of this podcast? Mm-hmm. And so I just decided I was going to speak up. And I said, you know, Garrett, I don't know how you're going to react to this. And I don't know, you know, if it's going to ruin our friendship, but I feel something and I don't know how to describe this. And so, you know, we started talking and that led to about 2 months of conversations, which led to about 2 years of exploring, you know, is this a relationship that can work? And during that time, we dated women as well. We weren't exclusive. And we were really exploring, you know, can the physical side of things happen? Anyway, we are married today. We've been together for over 9 years. But this was all going on. And I knew that I had to leave my job because I thought, if I'm getting this sick, clearly something is wrong here. And so I was an owner of this company. I gave a year's notice. I never recommend anyone listening to that. But, you know, I was an owner, so I felt like it was the right thing to do. And we restructured things. And during that time, I'm navigating this new relationship. I'm not telling anyone about it because we didn't know if it was real, if it was like a you might die desperation type thing. And so we're navigating this. I'm trying to heal myself. And I'm also trying to figure out what my next career move is. And so I ended up, you know, enrolling in nutrition school and herbalism school. So at this time, I'm working full time, going to 2 schools full time, navigating this relationship and trying to heal myself. It was by far the worst year of my life. But the year ended and I, you know, it just coincided that we had decided that we were going to tell people about our relationship at pretty much the end of the year, which was also when I was leaving my job. And so I had just started telling my family about our relationship. We had just moved in, just the two of us, and I started being the herbalist to Boston's, you know, entrepreneurs. And I thought, well, that, you know, I was sick. I can help these people get better and these people not burn themselves out. And I did that for, you know, a few months, but I didn't love it, honestly. And I wasn't making a lot of money. And I thought, well, shit, now I'm back at square one. And so I started writing about my experiences, not yet my relationship, because that felt a little too heavy to tell the world. But I started writing about, you know, success and redefining success and how I had success at a young age and really exploring that, what it means to live a more aligned life with myself. And, you know, a few months after starting this blog, a publisher reached out to me and said, Mike, can I give you a book deal? I want you to write about this in a book. And I thought, well, I don't even know what I'm doing with my life. Sure. You want to give me an advance? I will take an advance and I'll write that book. And so I wrote this book. And in the book, I talked about my relationship with Garrett. And I thought, well, shit, I have to tell people in my life about this relationship if it's going to be published in a book next year. And of course, my closest friends and family knew, but not my extended network. And so I wrote a blog post on my website and I just said, you know, I'm in this relationship. It's not something I expected. And at the time, a publication named Mind Body Green, I used to write for them. And they said, well, would you adapt what you wrote for your blog for our publication? So I said, okay, basically same post. I changed a few things and I wrote it for them and I went to bed that night. Well, the next morning I woke up and 100,000 people had shared that post. Mm.
100,000 people shared it?
Shared it. So millions, many millions had read this article at this point. It was the most overwhelming experience of my life. I got, I kid you not, you know, thousands of emails that week. Some of them very positive. You know, people from all over the world, you know, people from every country you can imagine saying, you know, I have a similar experience or you've given me opportunity to talk about this. Certainly a lot of hate mail and people accusing me of things from all sides. And so it was not something I expected. You know, NPR was calling me, Huffington Post, Yahoo News was calling to interview me. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, Mike, what did you do to prepare for this? And I think my response is, if I knew this was going to happen, I never would have written that article. This wasn't like something I wanted or planned for. I don't think anybody wants millions of people talking about their sex life, or at least I certainly don't. And so this was really overwhelming because here I am, you know, I've got all these people talking about me, And I still don't have a business model. I'm not really making any money. You know, I've got this book coming out in a year, but otherwise I've got nothing going on. And I felt like such a failure. And so I really went back to all the life purpose books and the life purpose teachings. I mean, honestly, I've read every book. I have done every life purpose training, you know. And so I went there and they all say, you know, find your passions, find your skills, find, you know, what the world needs, and then circle that middle point. What's in between there? I said, all right. Let me think about this. What do these things have in common? I'm this branding and PR guy. I got really sick. I healed myself. I'm an herbalist. I'm a writer. I've got a book deal. And I've talked about, you know, sexuality in my relationship. There's got to be something here. I said, oh my God, it is so obvious. How did I miss it? I meant to create a blogging course. And it's not just going to be any old blogging course. I mean, yeah, it's going to help you get a book deal. But it's going to be deep. It's going to be spiritual. It's going to be about finding your voice, knowing your brand, knowing who you are as a person. And so, you know, this is at the end of a year of really working on myself and, you know, trying to make a business work. And so I had no money left. But I thought, you know, you've got to go pro, they all say. Like, you've got to put every dollar into this thing. And so I got the fancy lighting kit and a business partner and a microphone and, you know, Facebook ads and web designer and the whole bit. And I put this thing out into the world. I spent thousands on this thing. I put it out into the world just sure this is going to take off. This is my golden ticket. And I think five people bought it. It was a colossal failure. I lost thousands of dollars on this. And I just thought, I'm done. I am so done. You know, I put everything out into the world. I have millions of people talking about intimate things about my life, asking me invasive questions. I, you know, am not making money. I don't know what to do. I feel like I took those chances. I took the big risks that the world told me to take, and it all failed. And I felt like such a failure that I was just going to give up. And I decided I was going to call my partners at my own company and see if I have a job at my own company. I don't even know if I have a job because I can't do this anymore. And so before, the day before I was planning on leaving, I decided to host what I called a failure celebration. And really the idea or the thinking around that was, you know, like, I've done hard things that even put me in the path of failure. Like, I had to at least do something, take some risks to fail in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I want to celebrate that, like, I did those things. So yeah, I failed, but I failed for good reason. Mm-hmm. And it was really just to reclaim some dignity around this year. And so I went into a Facebook group I was a part of, full of a bunch of spiritual entrepreneurs. And I offered the one thing that I was confident in, the one thing I knew I was really good at, which is branding. And I offered to give, you know, free branding sessions the entire day, like six in a row, you know, all day long. I had to literally stop sessions to pee. But I said, I don't even care. Like, I'm just going to give everything I got because tomorrow I'm leaving and this is my failure celebration. And I told you before, you know, I'm used to working with these like healthcare executives and politicians and tech billionaires and celebrities, but these people were more like life coaches and therapists and artists and healers and all types of cool people. And every single one of them said to me that day, some variation of, Mike, you didn't just tell me my brand, you explained my entire life purpose. Mm-hmm. Everything's starting to make sense. And so you can imagine, I'm sitting there like, what the fuck? That doesn't make sense. I don't know what you're talking about. You are crazy. That's not real. And I sat there and, you know, I figured, what do I have to lose at this point? So I went, got my whiteboard out and spent 2 hours doing the same thing on them, on myself that I did on them. Mm. And I came out with six. And those words are aligned, zany, free, unmistakable, successful, and vulnerable. The words I said at the beginning. Mm. And it started to explain to me, oh my God, there was this click. Like, that's, I understand why my relationship felt good, why, you know, PR was successful but not fulfilling, why this blogging course failed, why writing a blog was good but the book deal didn't feel as good. It just started explaining, like, what within that I was sensitive to, what started making sense since I was little, like all my trauma. And so as I'm kind of having this epiphany moment, I got an email from one of these women who I had worked with that day. And she said, you know, Mike, my friend wants to hire you for this thing we did today. What do you call it? Can she hire you? And I said, I don't know. I don't know what to call this. I mean, it's branding, but you're claiming to me that it's life purpose. I guess it's sacred branding. I'll call it sacred branding. I just slapped that name on it. the next day I had one client. So I said, okay, I'll work with this one client. And then 3 weeks later, I had a full schedule. And that was 7 years ago now. So I never ended up leaving. And since then, we've been doing this work. It's certainly evolved in a lot of ways. And I've worked with, you know, you name it, from comedians and drag queens, you know, people working on intimacy issues and wanting to understand their intimacy, or, you know, sex language, language in the bedroom, people healing from trauma, eating disorders. I mean, a lot of different things people have used this work for over the years.
So sacred. Why'd you choose that word?
You know, I think at the time, I mean, I think everything is more subconscious than we realize. But at the time, it consciously, it felt like, okay, this is branding, but it's reclaiming what branding is. You know, I think today we think of branding as a very objectifying thing. And truthfully, branding has an objectifying root, right? The word brand means to burn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we know that because we like brand paddle, right? You burn a mark into them. You impose a mark onto them. Or, you know, during the Holocaust, human beings were branded. You know, they were marked with something. And this term, which, you know, obviously today is a more conceptual term, is still this kind of putting myself in the box, you know, marking myself with something. I'm the bubbly life coach. I'm the, you know, brooding writer. I'm the, is, and that's great. But like most life purpose talk conversations, how does that apply to your trauma? Your relationships? You know, most of the time we're talking about something that's aspirational or achievable. We'll say, my purpose is to be a life coach. My purpose is to write a book. And that's cool. But if, you know, you can achieve it, that means you can also fail it. And that doesn't make any sense. How could you fail your purpose? And how could you fail your brand? I mean, it's who you are. It's the brand of being. And furthermore, if you can achieve it, it implies you didn't have it at a certain point. And so, you know, that doesn't make sense. Did you just not have a purpose as a baby? Like, that doesn't make sense at all. And so for me, you know, at the time, maybe I didn't think about or understand these things, but I thought what we think of as branding is limited. And people here are telling me that I'm offering them something deeper, something more purposeful. So that seems sacred to me. I want to reclaim this idea that we have an essence in energy medicine, a way of being in the world that no one else has. The way we have sex is different than anyone. The way we speak or give interviews, the way we coach or support one another, the way that we create art, the way that we do anything in the world is unique. That's who we are. And so, over, you know, at the time I didn't know this, but over the years I've come to learn and understand that, you know, the one thing we have even before language, even before any conditioning or indoctrination, is a sensitivity, right? You know, some babies are sensitive to music. And if you're sensitive to music, you can probably hear notes that I can't hear. And some babies are sensitive to freedom. And if you're sensitive to freedom, you're probably going to feel trapped easier than I am. And you're going to always look for opportunities to free yourself or free others. And these sensitivities start coloring our experiences. We, you know, literally sense more life there. We see, taste, touch, smell, hear life there, right? We experience it deeper. So we're going to split hairs and be more experts or see nuances that others can't see. We're going to hold trauma around those things because, you know, we're experiencing life deeper there. They're going to be a continuum on which we have the highest highs and lowest lows. And, you know, that to me speaks a lot more to our brand of being or to our quote unquote purpose, because now what's purpose is more subjective. It's not, hey, my purpose is to be a life coach. It's the why, right? Mm-hmm. The word purpose means why. It's why does life coaching feel purposeful? Does it make you feel, to use my words, vulnerable or zany or free or unmistakable? The things that make you feel those things will always feel purposeful and fulfilling. And they're the things you're naturally best at. My relationships that make me feel those, my friendships that make me feel those will always be purposeful. My purpose isn't a container. It's the essence inside. And even if that container shatters, if I know the essence, I can go find a new container. If I lose a job, if I go through a divorce, if I lose a friendship, I can grieve those things, of course, but I can understand what I was getting out of it that made me feel so alive and find new ways to begin to feel those things.
Hmm. Yeah, I was having a conversation with someone yesterday, and I can't quite remember who it was with, but I was talking about how the whole question of who am I?
Yeah.
Which is something I've, entertained a lot doing this podcast, and also in the reading that I'm doing, the spiritual sort of pursuits that I have. Mm-hmm. Most of the time when you ask people who they are, they almost invariably respond with what they do.
Yes.
Right. And, you know, it's like you were saying, who I am is, it can't be taken away.
Yeah.
What I do can end.
Mm-hmm. And it does.
Or we don't accomplish it or whatever. And so when we have that taken away from us, we're back to who am I?
Yeah, absolutely. And we see that, you know, my work, we see a lot of people who've gone through divorce or, you know, spouse has passed or, you know, a layoff or retirement. And there's this question of who am I now? And I purposely, you know, answered your first question of Mike, you know, what do you do? Who are you? With saying my sensitivities, because the truth is, you know, there was a certain point in my life, a lot of my life, that I would have led with labels, because that's where I gained my worth. That's where I gained my power. You know, saying I've done this impressive work over here, I made X money over here, that gave me worth, conditional worth, but worth. And that's the thing, is anything that's what we do or any container outside of us is conditional. It can go away one day. You know, our looks will change, our bodies will change, our sex drive will change, our jobs will change, our relationships will change, but we don't. This kind of eternal essence. And it's a thing that no one else in the world can imitate or copy. No one can. You can speak the exact same words I'm speaking right now, and you can never deliver them with the same energy that I have, because that's who I am. And the same is true for you. And the same is true for everyone listening. And I just think knowing that builds so much confidence, not unshakable confidence and not conditional confidence, because, you know, it's kind of, if I know who I am in, like, let's say sex, right? Like I teach a class, Discover Your Brand in Bed. If I know without a doubt the sex that's most fulfilling for me and the sex that I can offer that is deeply intimate and connection, which is mine, right? Sex for me is always like therapy. It's this incredibly vulnerable, crazy, you know, experience, because that's my gift of vulnerability. And knowing that makes me realize, why would I be insecure ever sexually? Like if my husband, you know, we get divorced one day, you know, knock on wood, but let's say we do, and he goes meet someone else. I hope they're a really lovely, wonderful person, but they can never have sex the way I can. Okay. They can, you know, I used to, you know, speaking of this topic of sex and body image, I used to have a disempowered relationship with my body. So I didn't always feel that I was sexy and confident. And, you know, a few years ago, I thought, well, come on, Mike, you do this work. You should, you know, figure this one out. And I thought, all right, Mike, what with my body would make me feel vulnerable and zany and free? I thought, oh my gosh, duh, dancing naked in front of the mirror. Oh, so man. Every day for a year, while the water was heating up, you know, for 2 minutes, before I got in that shower, I danced naked vulnerably and zanily, freely dancing, and just looked at my body. And there were days where I didn't feel attractive. There were days where I, you know, didn't want to do it. But every day for a year, I did not miss a day. And then at the end of that year, it didn't even click for me that this was related. I booked my first boudoir photo session, and I had my first nude photos, and I didn't realize this was related. And I got those photos back, and I thought, okay, these are very private. They're for me, maybe my husband. Nobody's going to see these photos. I got those photos back. Oh my God. I've shared them with my mom. I posted them on the internet. I don't care who sees those photos, because I feel so sexy and confident. And what I realized is I know what I'm most sensitive to, and I know what my brand is, my essence. So if I get that, then leaning into that is what's going to make me feel confident. Anything else is going to be me trying to be someone else. Mm-hmm. And you never have to try to be yourself. If you're trying, it means you're being somebody else. So you know, I've spent so much of my life building success by being somebody else and then feeling my self-esteem plummet, because what I'm essentially telling myself is that I'm not good enough. The more success I get as someone else is saying, hey, you're not actually good enough. You've got to be someone else to be good enough. And counterintuitively, it makes you have less self-esteem to be more successful. Mm-hmm. And I finally realized I don't have to try. Being myself is like having coffee with a best friend. And hours fly by. and genius just spills out of you and you're having so much fun and you don't think, you don't try, you're not like, am I saying the right thing or doing the right thing and all technical. But most of us don't have experiences like that in life. We have that one friend and then we forget the thing that makes us so magnetic there and we try to be someone else in business or someone else in relationships or someone else wherever because of conditioning.
Right.
And it's, you know, for me, my path is really breaking those things down, helping people realize you want to be really successful in business, do the thing no one else can do in the world. Give that essence. And if you give it over and over again, you don't need buying 1,000 times. You don't need people to like your podcast and your website. You just need people to resonate once. Because if they resonate, it's all authentic. It's built on the same energy. And either they like you or they don't. And the people who don't like me, great. Go find the person that you do like. The people that do like me, I'm always going to be myself. So you like me once, you can like me every time.
Hmm. You know, you use the word conditioning. And as I'm listening to you, you know, a couple times in my mind, I thought, but isn't it sad that so many of us are conditioned to be something other than who we are?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, if, you know, our school system in this country is still designed for people who work on assembly lines.
Yes.
You know, and the time of day that we get up in the morning, when we eat our meals, you know, it's all designed around making money for somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. It's something I've been like really sensitive to. Especially in the last year, just everything we do is based on so much. It can be based on what someone else wants from us, what the expectations are. And it doesn't serve us always. It doesn't serve us. And then I think the way a lot of people make sense of that, reconcile that, is their lives are about their family.
Yeah.
You know, raising kids or whatever. Or maybe it's their partnership. But, you know, what if that goes wrong? Then where are you? You know?
You know, thank you for so much for saying that. Because, you know, the thing about, you know, family and relationships and job and putting all of our worth or fulfillment or happiness into one of those containers, which these are beautiful things. Of course, we want to feel fulfilled there. But the thing that putting it all in the one place is it's conditional.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, conditional and conditioning, you know, come from that same root. It's something that our kids are going to, you know, leave the home at one point. Our, you know, families may change. We may get divorced. We may lose a job. We may, any of these things can be conditional. The power isn't in those things. The reason we're satisfied there is because who we are and what our needs are being met. And if we know those needs, those things can change and we can adapt because we're more fluid. You know, we're the water inside the cup. You can pour that water from one cup to another without losing the essence. So sometimes it's not going to be the right cup anymore. You know, sometimes I've got to leave the house and I want to put my tea into a to-go cup. That's fine. I change the container, but the essence doesn't actually change. And understanding that has been so pivotal for me because you're right. I mean, we have so much conditioning from society, you know, what we should look like, you know, what, you know, is masculine or what men should do, what, you know, is the right body type, what is the right, you know, sex and sexuality, and all these things come up and we're, you know, it creates so much shame because we think we have shame praise dichotomy. We think, you know, conditioning turns us into this is praiseworthy, that's shameful. So I'm going to hide the parts of myself society tells me shameful. I'm going to, you know, upplay the parts of me that society tells me is praiseworthy. And I never get to be myself, right? Mm. I'm being somebody else. And I'm saying, well, you know, I get my worth in this job over here or taking care of my kids. But even that's conditional too, because that's going to change somewhere. Doesn't mean we don't want to have loving relationships. I hope we all do. But the reason it's so loving for me is because it's vulnerable and deep. Because I feel free to be myself. Mm. Because, you know, I can be unmistakable. Because I can be zany and weird and playful. And people have told me all my life, Mike, you're too much. You're too emotional. You're too sensitive. You're too passionate. You're too loud. You're too intense. You're too much. And this is conditioning, right? I used to really shame myself and say, oh my God, if I were a little bit different, if I were not too much, not, you know, not enough, then I would be better. And now I realize they're not talking about me. They're talking about the container. What they're saying is, you're too much for me to handle in this container. They're saying the container is too small. That nothing's wrong with me. You know, if I had a gallon of water and I tried to pour it into a tiny little cup and spilled all over the floor, I wouldn't scream at the water for being too much. I would get a bigger pot. And so that's us, right? That's life. If we know who we are and our sensitivities, you know, we can start unpacking who we aren't. You know, I always say you can't take out who you aren't unless you know who you are. But if we know that with conviction, you know, I'll tell you one story. Yeah, you're firing me up here. One story I've got that I think you'll like is I've experimented using my work with children just a little bit. And, you know, years ago, when I was experimenting, my niece was the first person I used. She was 6 years old at the time. And so I did this work with her and, you know, I adapted it. It only took me 20 minutes, not as long as I usually do, because kids, I knew I wouldn't have her attention that long. But one of the words, one of the sensitivities we discovered was the word quiet. And I thought, that's interesting. And then she went off on her merry way. Well, a month later, my mom called me and said, oh my God, the most miraculous thing happened. I have to tell you. And I said, well, what is it? And she said, you know, my niece was at kindergarten and a little girl at kindergarten was bullying her and was saying, you know, you're shy and you're awkward and something's wrong with you. And my niece said, no, my uncle told me that I'm quiet. And that's one of my superpowers. That's what makes me different than anyone in the world. And I bet that you have superpowers too. You can just ask my uncle and he'll tell you your superpowers.
Oh, man, that's great.
I thought, how miraculous to start with yourself first. We're not fitting into those containers. We're saying we're the right thing and let's have containers that fit us. And I just think, what would my life have been like? What would my conditioning be like if I had that at 6 years old?
Yeah, well, you know, that's those are the types of questions we have to ask ourselves to heal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the real answer is, well, how to heal those things is to provide it for ourselves.
Yes.
You know, like you're doing, like you did. You did. What you gave to all those people, you also gave to yourself. It's really cool that you shared it with your niece and, you know, what a great bit of feedback to get, right?
Yeah.
Is there anything better than that?
No, I mean, right, right. And that's why I do this work, right? And, you know, I think the cool thing is that we all have this, you know, I call it mapping sensitivities because we're just mapping our lived experiences. We're just mapping, you know, so many people will say to me, oh, Mike, I wasted so much time in that relationship, or I wasted so much time before I knew my purpose. You know, if only I did this work younger, or whatever their story is. And the thing is, no moment of our lived experience is wasted, right? We haven't wasted anything. So all we have is just this huge treasure trove of data, just tons of data that all of our sensitivities are going to be involved in because that's how we experience life. That's our lens on the world. Mm-hmm. And so all we have to do is map those things. Map moments of trauma, map, you know, happy moments, map sad moments, map fulfilling or successful moments. And we start seeing the same patterns over and over again. And we can start to say, oh, whenever I'm happy, I have some sense of freedom and some sense of vulnerability and some sense of, you know, feeling like zany and crazy. And whenever I'm, you know, sad or things are really bad, I have a sense that I have to protect myself. And I have a sense that I'm trapped and I have a sense that I, you know, can't be zany and playful or that people think I'm too much or crazy. And so we start to see these sensitivities, these continuums on which we live. And it's not a hard thing to do. Anybody can go and start map these things. You know, we always offer like a series of questions. So actually we have a little 36-minute training on my website that's free and just has a series of questions that people can start answering. And it gives them insight into, oh, I can see some patterns or some sensitivities that show up. And then all we want to do is know what are those overarching sensitivities that are in every moment of our lives.
Hmm. You know, this, it goes back to something that I believe and, you know, like to remind people is that we already have all the answers.
Yeah,
we do. We do. And, you know, I was reading this morning about, have you heard of Ramana Maharshi?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. He was a Indian sage, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he this book, The Spiritual Teachings of Ramana Maharshi, it begins with who am I? And it just goes deeper and deeper and deeper into that question. It's like a dialogue between him and a student. And this morning, what I was reading, it was about self-realization. And his point was that, you know, all we need to do is recognize that we're already there. You know, we are already realized.
Yeah.
We get off track by questioning ourselves. All we have to do is acknowledge that the self, capital S, self, is already here. It already exists, and acknowledge it and validate it. And like you're talking about, kind of teasing out the different elements of it so that I can deepen it. It's awesome stuff, man.
You know, you're making me think of a story, and I know a little bit of some of the work you do, and it made me think of that. A few years ago, we had a woman who was struggling with alcoholism and, you know, alcohol substance abuse, and she had a lot of shame. And so we went through this work, as we always do, and she discovered that one of her sensitivities was the word enchanted. And she started journaling about how when she was a little girl, she felt enchanted all the time. You know, she would play with, you know, in the garden with fairies, you know, and she had fairy crowns and all this stuff. The world was enchanting to her. And then she got older and life and conditioning told her that, you know, that wasn't appropriate to play with, you know, fairies and fairy gardens and all this stuff. And it was at this moment that she really realized that as an adult, the only time she could ever pinpoint feeling enchanted is when she was drunk. It was the only time as an adult she could feel it. And she was able to kind of let go of so much shame and say, you know, I'm not broken or fucked up or wrong. You know, I was trying to feel a core sensitivity. There was something that I didn't know how else to give myself. And this was the only way that I was able to experience that sensation, that coming home to myself. Mm-hmm. And it really helped her to move through some of that shame and, you know, ultimately find other pathways to feel enchanted. Mm-hmm. I always think back to that story because I think, you know, to your point, we're always, like, the answers are inside of us and we're always deepening into ourselves. We're always, you know, everything we do is for a reason. You know, humans, contrary to popular belief, we're not actually irrational. We may not know the reason why, we may not understand it, but we always have a reason for doing what we're doing. We're trying to fulfill some need. And so for me, it's just been so healing to understand, oh, that's why I did that. I don't have to agree with or condone the behavior, but I can forgive it because I understand the why behind it. And that's, I think, for me, what's been so empowering about sensitivity work.
Well, and, you know, the world's a better place if we can try to understand each other and ourselves.
Yeah.
And for me, I think I look at addiction now at this point in my life as a betrayal of self.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because my experience, well, for me, it was a way to try to deal with that betrayal of self. Because rather than listening to that inner voice, trusting that I had the answers inside, part of what I did was try to keep the favor of the people around me, family, you know, hold on to the love that I had, not risk losing it. And I needed it. So I didn't have the ego strength or the self-esteem to say, screw you, I'm going to do whatever I want and I'm going to be fine. I just didn't. But, you know, going through, this is why by the time I was 23, I almost drank myself to death. And, you know, do I have a gene? I don't know. Maybe. Was I physiologically dependent on alcohol? Yeah. Did I like to drink? Yeah. But, you know, I had no sense of meaning or purpose. And I felt lost. I felt stuck. I felt like, you know, I was a kid. Yeah. How do I ever get out of this place where I'm stuck? I really thought everything feels so permanent at that age, especially when we're a little off track. We just think everything is so, so permanent. And that's how I felt. But I also knew when it came time for me to stop drinking, there were things I wanted to do that I wanted to have meaning. I wanted to have purpose. And, you know, one of the stories that I tell occasionally, I almost forget about this, but did you ever see the movie Mr. Holland's Opus?
I have, yeah.
Well, if you haven't seen that, if you're listening and you haven't seen that, go watch it. So long story short, I ended up in detox, right? At this treatment facility where I went. It was, you know, my mom had to fly me to a rehab center in Florida, where, you know, which a lot of people go through, you know? But when I got to this place and was dropped off, you know, it's like midnight on a Saturday night, new surroundings. It's God knows what you're supposed to expect in an environment like this. I had no idea really what I was getting myself into. And it was an extraordinarily sad, painful time. So I wasn't exactly sleeping, you know. And I get in there late this night, and it was long enough ago that, you know, there were still VCRs and VHS tapes and movies rented from Blockbuster. And this overnight tech who's there says to me, "Hey, Tom, I rented a couple movies, you know, for the clients tonight. You know, if you want to watch one, we could do that." So, okay. Mr. Holland's Opus. So the first day of my sobriety, on a Saturday night in the middle of the night, watched Mr. Holland's Opus. And the significance of it was not lost on me at that time, you know, because I always knew I wanted to help people somehow. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know what shape it would take, but I knew I wanted to help people. I wanted my life to matter. I wanted to contribute to other people's lives. And here was a guy. It's a story about a guy who has all this vision. And he's going to go do this thing. And it doesn't work out that way. And he feels like a complete failure until he realizes that the real work of art was how he influenced everyone's lives.
Yeah.
And it gives me chills to think about that. You know, that's the first movie I watched sober, you know, day one.
Wow. Yeah. That's a powerful story. Thank you for sharing that.
And, yeah.
You know, one thing, just thinking about your story, is how I found so many people who are so sensitive. You know, I define the word sensitive as literally able to sense more engaged with life, feeling life, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling more. Sensitive have had, you know, a lot of people I know who've had challenges with addiction have also been very sensitive people, you know, feeling things so deeply and wanting to have purpose, wanting to, you know, do something great for the world. But we live in a very challenging world right now, and it can be really overwhelming and challenging, and we don't know and we feel lost. And, you know, I know for myself, it's just where it can be so overwhelming that I want to numb some of that sensitivity. Mm-hmm. I want to disassociate for a moment. And, you know, what I'm so interested in life is this idea of, like, that same sensitivity that, you know, Mr. Holland felt, or you felt, or any of us felt, is what drives you to do the work that you do. It's what, you know, drives you to, you know, we might feel that exquisite pain of, you know, existential crisis because we don't know what our purpose is, or we feel stuck, or we feel confused. But the fact that we still feel that pain and we haven't totally disconnected or checked out from it means we're still sensitive. I mean, sensitivity is the thing that means we're alive. You know, rocks may not be sensitive, but we are. We can feel life coursing through us. And that sometimes looks like trauma. Sometimes that looks like pain. It doesn't mean it's always going to be happy, but isn't that the flip side of purpose and fulfillment? to feel these shadow things and know that, you know, I think if we feel those, for me these days, and I feel something strongly, instead of, you know, feeling really bad about myself, which in the past I have, and why am I so goddamn sensitive, and why can't I just, you know, be easy and light about this? I've learned to say, okay, like, I care. I'm alive. Something really matters here. There's purpose here. This is something I want to help somebody else with. This is something I want to do. And I just think, how many miraculous people like you, like, you know, a lot of people listening, I'm sure, have done incredible work and helped to change lives of so many because of something they were sensitive to.
Yeah. Well, to me, that's what, how it all makes sense. You know, the struggles that we have, you know, there's so many, it's like all the things that I've been through in my life that I've struggled with in my life. Invariably, there's a point at which that the switch is flipped and that becomes a gift that I get to share with someone else. A big one in my life, was, you know, I experienced significant emotional abuse at the hands of an older brother. And if you don't know what that's like, I mean, you know, it's mind boggling. It's, you know, to me, to be hurt by someone who is supposed to love you as much, if not more, than anyone else, you know, family member, systematically. And, so there's that. It's confusing for a kid to go through just because, wait a minute, this is supposed to be my brother. I really love him. I look up to him, yet, you know, he treats me like garbage, and, you know, it's confusing. And then, and then there's, it's a sense of betrayal, you know? And also you have these feelings of, I love him and I admire him, but I'd also like to bash his head in with a baseball bat in the middle of the night. Wait, you know, like, I mean, it's so confusing. And it, you know, it hurts so much to go through that when, you know, I'm a really loving guy. Like, all I wanted was, even if he didn't give me his love, to be able to love him without him screwing it up. You know, I just wanted to love him, but to not be able to do that, you know, that it is a traumatic experience. And, you know, it's like, I have lived the moment when at 40 years old, a kid sits in front of me in my office to talk to me about how his older brother treated him. And I could articulate that confusion in a way that validated it for him. And let him know, you know what, dude, there's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you. And, you know, it's that. And then the love between us, I mean, it almost makes it all worth it. You know, like, having, it probably does, truth be told, to have gone through all that, you know, it makes sense. And that's the beauty of the suffering is, you know, if we can find the meaning of it, if we can be patient enough with it and give it the time, you know, it will all eventually make sense.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. That's so beautiful. And I mean, yeah, I think, you know, purpose, meaning, you know, connection, essence, like, just understanding that every moment of life, even the, you know, not that we have to condone these things, not that we have to wish them upon ourselves or anyone, of course not, but understanding that we are forged by all of these moments for better or worse. And that same sensitivity that, you know, you were such a loving kid that you just wanted to give love, to your brother and receive love from your brother is that same love that you're now able to share with your clients,
right.
The same love that you're able to share on this podcast. And that sensitivity, you know, you experience deeper than anyone. I'm sure that you've experienced the highest highs and lowest mm-hmm. lows of love. And that means that you're here to teach all of us about that, right? Mm-hmm. You are more of an expert on that than other people are because you are sensitive to that thing. And I think that's what really fires me up is that a lot of times when we talk about purpose or we talk about authenticity or any of these things, we really only talk about the positive side. We only talk about the aspirational side. So it's like, oh, my purpose is to do X, Y, and Z. But when do we think we need purpose more? On the good stuff or on the trauma and the stuff that's been really painful? Of course, that's where we want more meaning and explanation. And so I just think like a lot of the stuff out there that's only focused on the really positive and happy stuff without helping us to have meaning or explanation for the stuff that's painful is sort of shame inducing. It really invalidates our experience. And I just think it's really beautiful when we can look at both sides and, you know, can kind of connect that circle, have it come full circle.
Well, and you know, something I thought of early in our conversation, you know, I don't remember exactly what it was you said, but you know, you talked about the shame and then the good side and how, you know, that duality, when, you know, real functional people are able to acknowledge and experience the gray areas. You know, there's a bit of good in the worst of us and a bit of bad in the best of us, all that stuff. And, you know, we live in this culture where there is such a thing as toxic positivity. You know, there was a meme going around today. I saw, I didn't read it, but it was a Brené Brown was interviewing someone and they were talking about that very thing, because I think especially online where you have people who are out there trying to spread positivity, you know, and it can amount to spiritual bypassing at times.
Yes. Yes.
But the truth is, and we're so good about avoiding the pain, avoiding the suffering, and it never goes away. We have to experience it sooner or later. And if we don't experience it directly, we experience it indirectly. And, you know, if we don't tend our wounds, we bleed all over the people we love, that whole thing.
Sure.
But in order to really experience joy, to really know joy, we have to know suffering.
Yeah.
The joy doesn't have any meaning. The happiness doesn't have any meaning unless we know sadness.
And I think, you know, in my language, when you're speaking this, that we numb out, right? So we numb out all the time when we don't want to, you know, experience the suffering or the sadness. We numb down a little bit, whether it's spiritual bypassing, cognitive dissonance, you know, whether we're using substances like we talk about, or, you know, zoning out on TV. We're trying to numb out a little bit. So how could we experience extreme joy if we can't experience the extreme opposite side? Because we've numbed a little bit. And I'm so interested, you know, the more, the older I get, the more I'm interested in being more sensitive to life. I want to feel everything to the fullest because I want to have extreme joy. I want to be fully present in my life. I want, you know, at my wedding, my husband and I, this is how crazy we are, we walked down to the aisle to a song about experiencing the hell and paradise on earth. Because I want all of it. I don't want to marry my husband for, you know, one perfect day. I want, if we have kids, you know, screaming babies at 4 a.m. I want money concerns. I want fights. I want a real adventure, a real partnership together that forces me to grow and strengthen and connect and all these things. And I just think, you know, we don't have to be afraid of life. Like, there, yes, there's extreme pain, and yes, it's hard. And I'm not saying that any of this is easy by any means. I mean, I've been through hell and back, and I know everyone else has too. But it's about being alive and being present in our life and knowing that we are so much more resilient and so much stronger than we give ourselves credit for. We've already done such hard things in our lives and we've survived them. And those gifts and lessons are just on the other side of that. What we can contribute and share with the world, the meaning and the purpose, is just on the other side of all of these painful things.
Mm. Well, and you know, manhood, masculinity, you know, I know these are topics that you're interested in every bit as much as I am. And, I did a little meme of my own not all that long ago. And, you know, just quoting myself, which is, you know, it said, you know, the modern man's odyssey is the emotional, you know? And I think, you know, we are so good at avoiding, and you use the expression afraid of life. Yeah. And that's what avoiding our emotional experience amounts to. Yeah. It really does. And,
yeah.
You know, like tears, that's another topic. I mean, for me, like the idea that we shouldn't cry to me is just ridiculous. It's a bodily function. And it's not only guys. I mean, it's prevalent with guys, mm-hmm. but I know plenty of women over the years who have bragged to me, you know, I was upset, but I didn't cry. And in my heart, I was just kind of sad for them because like, what? You needed to cry. Why didn't you cry? Sooner or later, the tears are going to have to come out. And, you know, these young guys that I work with, it takes so much more courage to cry than it does to hold in your tears.
Yeah.
It's so, you know, if you're a guy among a group of men, who's the coward? You know, the one who actually has the courage to cry or the one who pretends that he's not sad.
Yeah.
It's a no-brainer to me. And I do feel like as a society, as men, I think we're heading in the right direction. It's taking a long time. But, you know, I don't think it's just men. I think it's, you know, we're so emotionally repressed as a society. We're so afraid of living in a manner that we're in touch with our emotions. But if you're ignoring your feelings, you're ignoring yourself.
Yeah.
If you're denying your feelings, you're denying yourself. You are faking it. You're not being who you are.
You know, masculinity, this is a huge conversation, but, you know, on this, I think a lot about, you know, the kind of recent outbursts we've seen of kind of more violent or aggressive, you know, action, you know, by a lot of men and related to the masculinity conversation. One thing I think about is, you know, we don't have to assert or defend what's already been claimed. So if somebody says, hey, Mike, you know, you're less of a man because you're married to a man. Cool. You can think that thing. I don't have to assert or defend my own masculinity. Because I feel pretty fucking masculine. I feel right. very clear about my masculinity.
Right.
You
right.
don't need, you can say what you want. Right. I don't feel anything about that. But the thing is, and this is the real kicker, you can't claim what isn't authentically you. And I think we have a lot of, because of conditioning, and I want to kind of take the shame out of the conversation, like, there's a reason that it's so much easier to not cry than to cry, or you know, it's the less courageous thing.
Right.
It's because our society awards points for that.
Right. Like
you get validation. If your whole life you've been validated, like you're praised for that, you're shamed for crying, it's really hard to break these things down. So right now we live in a world where the definition of masculinity is so narrow that almost nobody matches it, but it's so narrow right now and people are trying to assert that. And you're always going to have to defend that because you aren't actually it. So you're always going to have to prove it. It's always going to be challenged and you're always going to have to prove it
right.
because that's not actually truly who you are. But, you know, I think this other idea that drives me crazy is that somehow being in touch with my femininity takes away from my masculinity. You know, I always say like stretching doesn't take away from strength training. It adds to it, right?
Right.
I'm just being more of all of me, being right. more of any part of me. Makes me more of all of me. So being more in touch with my true femininity makes me more masculine automatically, mm-hmm. my true masculine. And it does. the more that I'm in touch with my quote unquote feminine aspects, the more that I feel really connected and, you know, claimed in my masculine aspects. And I don't feel like I need to defend or prove. Like, you can totally say that I'm not masculine. That's great. But that has nothing to do with me. That has everything to do with you.
Right. Well, the other thing about this narrow definition that you're talking about, but for, you know, I will say that I take issue with the idea that, do we even really have a masculine side or a feminine side?
Right. That's a great point.
And do we really need to identify our emotional experience as our feminine side? Mm-hmm. And doesn't that make it inherently emasculating? And isn't that part of the problem? I mean,
you bring up such a great point here. And I think that this is something that, you know, I often try to preface these conversations with, like, hey, this is a construct that is predominant. And if it's helpful, let's talk about it,
right,
especially because we need to subvert it. But right, if it's not helpful, throw it away. You know, right, I'm interested in a trans affirming and non-binary affirming conversation. And so if these constructs, which we've grown up in, are helpful to kind of work through stuff, absolutely, we need to talk about them. But you're right. My feminine, my masculine, based on the society we're talking about, the culture or the time period, could be very different things. Those right, have been evolving definitions over time. So it's really arbitrary what we're talking about here. Right. And that's why I'm a lot more interested in just talking about sensitivities. What right, you're sensitive to is masculine and feminine and non-binary and, you know, right, and everything. Because
it doesn't,
who
it doesn't
are,
matter. Yeah. Well,
it doesn't matter. Exactly.
But going back to this definition of manhood, the idea of what it means to be a man, you know, this is something that, for me, I mean, I've always been somewhat interested in, but it really started to become more prevalent in my life as I was going through a divorce, because what I began to realize, as I really, you know, toward the end of the marriage and as I'm working really hard on myself, was that I wasn't showing up. Mm-hmm. Like I was wimping out. And, you know, so it was like, how am I, in terms of, you know, my way of being, was I really being a man in this? And, you know, the answer I gave myself was no, you know, not, I wasn't showing up in my male energy in that relationship. And, you know, it didn't work out very well, but anyway, so it got me to begin entertaining this question, what does it mean to be a man? And I've written about it and thought about it and talked about it ad nauseum. And what I finally concluded is that's the wrong question. That's the wrong question. It's not what does it mean to be a man. The real question for me is, what does it mean for me to be a man?
Yes.
What does it mean for me to be a man? Which could be completely different than what it means for you to be a man, but absolutely, no less valid. Mm-hmm. And the problem with this narrow idea, this narrow definition of what it means to be a man. First of all, it's nebulous. If right, you ask 15 different people, they're probably not going to give you a clear answer what it means to be a man. There might be a few consistencies, but not much. If you ask someone what it means to be a man, they don't know. So we're measuring guys against, we're gauging them against an invisible line. So absolutely, it's a setup for shame.
Absolutely.
It is. And so if I don't even know what it means, you know, so it's like society tells us it's basically saying, I don't know what it means to be a man, but if you're not it, man, you are a piece of shit.
Right.
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 Right. It's crazy.
And, you know, and this comes back to, you know, your brand of masculinity, your brand of man, your brand of self, your brand of whatever, you know, to go back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, branding being objectifying, nothing is objective. Like, objective is objectifying, right? It's reducing it to an object. Like, everything is subjective. We all live through a subjective human lens. What my experiences of life, what means to be a man for me, is obviously going to be different from you. And that's great. Why do I care, like, what you, you know, your path is what you need. That doesn't affect mine. I'm living from my own experience. I want to learn, who am I? You know, we go back to that question over and over again. Who am I? Why am I here? What do I have to offer the world? What do my experiences mean? What is my purpose? All of these questions are very personal, very subjective questions. And that, for me, can be applied to anything. We want to talk about masculinity. We want to talk about femininity. It doesn't really matter. If I know who I am with absolute certainty and I really define my life for myself, then it applies to every aspect of my life because it's who I am.
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the sad part of all this is that there's so many guys out there just stuck in all this.
Mm-hmm.
Not like lost.
Yeah.
Just completely lost. And, you know, the predominant emotion that is driving them, because emotions, you know, propel us through life, sure. Right? I mean, if I don't know if I'm a man or not, if I'm not so sure, and especially if it's like dependent upon how a woman responds to my advances or whatever, you know, I mean, if I'm so insecure about myself that I need a woman to be into me, mm-hmm. to feel good about myself, then, you know, it's going to come out weird and it's going to come out ugly, yeah. and abusively. And, yeah. And really it's, you know, there's an expression, hurt people,
yes.
you know? So there's that, but it's just, and it's so, And I mean, it's not like it's just all men. I mean, there are women who feed into misogyny too.
Of course.
You know, that's why it still exists.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Unfortunately, you know, conditioning, we all have these toxic layers of conditioning, whether we're talking about racism, misogyny, you know, homophobia, transphobia, whatever, inside of us. And, mm-hmm. you know, we've grown up in that society and it's our job to pull those things out. And, you know, I know. You know, a lot of work in my circles is a lot of women working through aspects of, you know, misogyny, a lot of, you know, gay men working through aspects of homophobia, all these things. Like, I'm not immune to it just because I'm married to a man. I'm not immune to homophobia within myself or others. And I have to check my biases and do my own work and unpack things and shame within myself every day. And that's work that we're all on this deconditioning path. And I just think knowing who I am really helps me pull out who I'm not. And these aspects of myself that I've been taught, but that aren't actually true for me.
Well, and I think, you know, we had a conversation before this, you know, where we kind of broke the ice over the phone. And mm-hmm. one of the things I brought up to you is, listen, I want to have permission to just sound ignorant and empower you to just tell me, because I don't know everything. And I do have inherent biases and I am ignorant of certain things. And I think part of the difficulty with all of this culturally, when it comes to racism and homophobia and all that stuff, is that there's none of us want to think of ourselves as bad people.
Yes.
And so, you know, I mean, it's impossible for me to not be racist the way that I grew up. I mean, uh-huh. it's in me and it has been, you know, always. I mean, I I'm not, you know, I please don't misquote me. I'm not saying I'm a racist.
No, I understand.
I'm saying I was brought up in, I just want to make sure all the listeners
understand.
This is a systemically racist society yes. that we yes. have been raised in. So how can we not be a part of it? And I think the responsibility for us is to acknowledge it, to recognize it, to be open to feedback about it, and to, you know, find a way for ourselves to feel okay about having a conversation about it.
Yeah.
These hard conversations, you know?
This is such an important topic. And, you know, a general rule I try to subscribe to is that if a person with a different lived experience than me is telling me they've been hurt by something, I should probably listen.
Right. You know, right.
Probably more of an expert on racism than I am. They know if the situation, even if I question, was that racist? I don't know. If they say it was, they probably know a lot more than I do. And I think that you really hit the nail on the head is that we, you know, internalize this idea of being racist, quote unquote, or being homophobic, quote unquote, as our whole identity, and therefore, you know, attack on our morality, attack on our character. And we think, well, oh my God, you said that I was racist here, so therefore you're saying I'm a bad person and I need to defend myself and I need to assert. And again, we're seeing that asserting, that defending again, rather than saying,
which is missing the point, actually.
Right. And then centering ourselves again, right? Now we're back in the center of attention.
Right.
Rather than saying, like, hey, you know, were hurt by something, or you're saying something that I have a blind spot to because of my lived experience, which is different than yours, and because I grew up in a racist, homophobic, transphobic, misogynistic, whatever society, I still have my own unpacking to do, my own deconditioning to do. We all do. Every human has problematic tendencies. Mm-hmm. Every human being, because we don't all have the same lived experience. So we are going to offend one another. We're going to have problematic things we've internalized that we don't even know that we have in there. And I think for me, you know, what I've really tried in my life to do is to start to say, hey, this isn't about me being a bad person. This is somebody just saying, hey, you inadvertently did something to hurt me. And now I can realize, oh, there's a bit of conditioning that I haven't pulled out just yet. Let me apologize. Let me change my behavior. Mm-hmm. And let me begin working on even more deconditioning for myself.
Yeah. Well, and validating.
Yeah.
Validating the feeling that they're expressing, you know, is so important. And to me, it's like the whole concept of reparations, for, you know, slavery.
Mm-hmm.
To me, if for no other reason, just to validate that the wrong was done, because, you know, that culture is also systematically invalidated. I mean, how many times have you heard people say the Civil War was over 200 years ago or, you know, I never owned slaves.
Yep.
But come on, you know, I mean, it's failing to take a minute to try to stand in somebody else's shoes.
Yeah.
Right. I'll tell you something that blew my mind a few years ago. I don't think I've talked about this on the podcast before, but I went through a little kick where I was looking into my lineage, ancestry.com, all that stuff. And I found there is a book called The Gentry Family of Indiana. And, you know, it's available on Google Books. So, and it's massive, you know, it was published right around 1900. So I haven't read the whole thing, but you know, it came with photographs of different gentries and, you know, I grew up in Indiana, you know, which is one of the three states that claims to be the birthplace of Abraham Lincoln, you know, and, always thought of us as the good guys. Always thought of, you know, being a Northern Union state, anti-slavery state. And, so, you know, I printed out about 100 pages of this book and I'm flipping through it. And of course, you know, there are all these prominent military men and they're all Confederates. They're all Confederates. And not only that, the only one who wasn't a Confederate officer owned 100 slaves and made them fight for the Union. I mean, and I, you know, went through the first 40 years of my life thinking, you know, that just assuming that nothing like that was the case in my lineage. And I mean, if you buy into the idea of intergenerational trauma or intergenerational anything, like, I mean, that wasn't all that long ago.
right?
I mean, it really wasn't all that long ago.
No, not at all.
And that really blew my mind. I mean, it's, if we keep our eyes open and kind of go through, we have moments like this where, you know, our beliefs are challenged and they need to be.
Absolutely.
And some people, I think if you're unhealthy, you get angry about it or you challenge it or whatever, but you know, I mean, it's so important with all this stuff that we be humble. You know, that we maintain some sense of humility. I don't know everything.
Right.
You know, I don't have to know everything. I don't.
And that's what's beautiful about life is that we all get to be experts for our own lived experience and share with one another. And, you know, you have wisdom I will never have. And everybody listening has wisdom I will never have and different lived experiences. So why would I assume I know your experience better than you do? I mean, the arrogance associated with that. I love to learn from people. I love to hear things. I love to be corrected because guess what? That means that I learned from somebody who has an experience I don't, and now I know more about the world, and that's a beautiful thing.
Well, and, you know, trying to understand is a way to show love.
Yeah.
Which is, if we have a job, I mean, if as the human race, if we have a purpose, it's to love. That's what I believe. Huh. And so if we can't even do that, you know, then what are we doing? Right. I mean, what the last thing I say at the end of every episode is be nice.
Yeah.
And it's like, I made a decision at one point a few years back, like, I'm not going to walk through life and not make eye contact with people and not say hello to people. And I'm just not going to live like that. That's not who I want to be. Right. I'm going to be intentional about being nice to people. Yeah. And it has improved the quality of my life.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes if all you can do is make somebody smile, I mean, you never know how bad someone needs that. You really don't.
We, you know, we have no idea the impact of our beingness in the world. How could you ever know your quote unquote value? There's this whole thing in entrepreneurship, people are all about, you know, charge what you're worth, charge your value. And we say, what does that mean though? Like, how do I know the impact that I'm having? I could be walking down the street and smile at someone and I could change their day. I could have someone smile at me and not walk out into the street and get hit by a car. So, like, all I have no idea. You can't put a price on my life or anyone's life. All I can do is show up and try to be the best person I can be and be nice to everyone and give my gifts and my sensitivities to every human I can every time and just hope that I did the best I could. I have no way. I'm not going to see, you know, the results of a lot of that out there in the world. I'm not going to hear from every person I've ever touched, but that's fine. That's great. I'm not doing it for validation. I'm doing it because I want to make this world the best place I can.
Well, this has been great, man. I could go on talking to you forever. And I'm looking forward to digging a little deeper on your website and looking at those questions. And I encourage anyone who's listening to do the same. This has been great. So, man, I feel like I need to catch my breath a little bit after all that. It's been fun. So looking back, Mike, over, you know, the beginning of your life up to this point, when was the hardest time? When was the time when, you know, the younger version of you needed a word of advice or some support? When would that have been? And what would you go back and say to him?
Yeah, that's a question right there. I'm thinking about this one moment when, this was before I even, you know, got sick, before anything. I remember I was at a party and I was opening a bottle of wine and it pulled out too quickly and somehow the corkscrew hit my face and it cut me. And so I ran to the bathroom to go wash my face. And I had a few drinks at this point, so you know, I was a little bit drunk, and I looked in the mirror and I looked at the blood fall, and I just thought for just a split second, you know, what if I just died right now? Like, would anybody care? Did my life matter? Like, does my life even matter at all? You know, why am I even here? And it was this moment that wasn't, you know, a serious suicidal ideation, but it also was this really kind of dark moment where I just felt that to the core of my being. And I felt like I don't really matter in this world. I hardly exist. Even though I had, you know, friends and this great job and all these things that I thought, you know, would really matter. And, you know, within 6 months, I got sick, and that's where my whole life kind of changed. And looking back at that moment, I just think to myself how much I was trying to be somebody that I wasn't, you know, trying so desperately to be this successful person and this, you know, like I was stressed out all the time. I was anxious all the time. And I was trying to keep it all together. And I would just love to like look at myself and just tell myself, you know, one, that you never have to try to be yourself. If you're trying, it means you're being somebody else. And who you are is invaluable. Who you are, it has gifts that you don't even know about. And they're gifts that validate every moment of your experience, every insecurity, every fear. The flip side of that is a huge gift that can help so many people. And if you can just learn to stop listening to what the world tells you you have to be and learn to be who you are and really, really fall in love with it, you will be shocked at what your life's going to take, what turns your life will take, and who you can become.
Mm. Well, I'm glad I've had those moments too. I think most of us do at some point or another. And as I'm listening to you, what I think about is, you know, the story of our lives, it's an arc, right?
Yeah.
And any one single point on that arc can seem pretty meaningless at times.
Yeah.
But if we can just have the patience to just be, you know, sooner or later, it all makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Well, Mike, this has been great. I appreciate this. Thank you so much. And
yeah.
I'd love to have you come back sometime, anytime.
Of course, I'd love to. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, there you have it, Mike Iamelli. So please take a minute to fill out the audience survey. There's a link in the show notes. You can find the show on Amazon, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, Google Podcasts, Listen Notes, Overcast, Pandora, Patreon, Podbay, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Radio Public, Spotify, Stitcher, and YouTube. Please subscribe, like, follow, whatever it is that's customary on the respective platform. If you enjoy listening to the show, please take the time to leave a rating or a review or both, preferably on Apple Podcasts. But if you're not an Apple user, Podchaser would be great. Or again, anywhere, any platform you use, if they give you the ability to leave a rating or review, please do so, but only if it's going to be positive. Let's be real here. If you know somebody who would enjoy this episode, another episode, the podcast in general, please share it with them. I try to make it easy to do that on the website. If you have questions or comments, you can call area code 561-247-4757. That's 561-247-4757. And leave a voice message. Maybe I'll even use it on an episode. Love to hear from you. Value any feedback you might have to offer. For early access to episodes, supplemental content, you can support the show on Patreon. That's patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. You can gain access to supplemental content for as little as $1 a month right now. Thank you to the band Punk Rock Opera whose music you hear throughout the show. Their songs are used with permission from the artist and under a Creative Commons license. Thank you to our sponsors, The Manor and Windrose Recovery. Thank you to Wendy Chin at Equivox for everything you do and all your support. And The Path to Authenticity is proud to support the I Speak Media Foundation. If you haven't checked out the website, please do. ThePathToAuthenticity.com. There you can find blog posts about a lot of the guests, the 20 questions that I do with guests, a lot of cool stuff. There's a cool player, a couple of them actually, on the site, and I'm proud of it. So please take a look at it. You can email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. Please become part of the Facebook community. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram. There are links in the show notes for Spotify, where you can find the Saturday playlist, the Sunday playlist. I'm always toying around with that stuff. I love music and love to be able to share the music I love with you guys. Right now, I'm listening a lot to this guy, Aaron Fraser. If you haven't checked out Introducing Aaron Fraser, it's pretty awesome stuff. Be cool to have him on the podcast someday. Anyway, thanks again to Mike Iamelli. You guys take care of yourselves out there. Please come back. Be nice.
Hey, We need a guitar player.
The Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.